Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 12th of April 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish, with me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we're delighted to say we are joined today by Alex Thompson, Eastern Approaches. And of course, Alex will be reporting from deep inside the Netherlands. Well, first of all, advert for the Nottingham Moot. We are saying repeatedly, if you are now really beginning to see the dangers of what's unfolding in UK, we maintain that a dictatorship is installing itself quite quickly now. What are we to do? Well, one of the first things we need to do is be sticking together, meeting people, exchanging ideas, and of course, taking action. So if you haven't got your tickets for the April the 22nd meeting in Nottingham, the Albert Hall, then you can get them online at thebritishconstitutiongroup.com. There will be tickets available at the door. However, if you'd rather do that, but it makes it easier for the British Constitution Group if we have some idea how many people are coming in advance. But really, this is the time for people to come together and to start to share ideas and act.
Before we get into this, should we just mention that Friday and Monday, being the bank holiday weekend, or the Easter weekend rather, we will not be producing a UK Column News those days?
That's correct. We are taking a break. That break is needed, but we'll be back
on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Right, let's get straight into it then. Alex, Guido Fox here, Labour candidate, don't vote for me.
This is a rather embarrassing episode for the Labour Party, but it throws up some interesting questions about the party machine. In this case, it was an election in the Scarborough ward of the North Yorkshire County Council, if I've got the details correct, which are happening on the 4th of May. And by some error, he calls it regional level, and he even capitalises the R of regional, because that's how they do things in the parties. Someone at regional level in the Labour machine officially put down two Labour names, a man and a woman, for the same ward of this election. So the man has decided to play the gallant and say, don't vote for me, vote for the lady instead. And it kind of shows up. Well, what could we say best? That we're not voting, in this case it's for councillors, but it would apply to MPs as well. We're not voting for individuals having listened to their platforms, and so we only have ourselves to blame at the quality of the politics we get. We're voting for icons and party platforms, and if the parties are so remote from the public now, they can even bungle so badly that they can put two dames down for the same ward, because the decision is being made 50 or even 500 miles away from the people.
Absolutely right. I just mentioned, Alex, that of course the capital R on regional is because it refers to regional in the sense of the European Union and devolution. And of course devolution is a European Union policy which the UK is busy implementing at the moment and will continue to implement whether we're in or out of the European Union. Another example of Brexit being a fraud.
Indeed.
Let's move on to fracking then. There was a legal challenge in the High Court this morning, and the judgment was given this morning, rather, on trying to prevent Quadrilla from producing the first frack in the UK since the 2011 frack near Blackpool. Now, this is Quadrilla's Lancashire shale gas site at Preston New Road. That's the state of it at the moment. The High Court, the Royal Courts of Justice, the High Court has decided that Quadrilla should be permitted to go ahead with their work. So this, of course, will up the ante with regard to the protection community and the protests that are going on there. Ian Crane, of course, will be continuing to report on these actions as they take place. Of course, they would like as much support as possible at Preston New Road and the other protection camps as this proceeds.
Yeah, and it's quite clear the government is going to proceed willy-nilly unless there's sufficient reaction from the general public.
Right, Alex, let's get on to the Netherlands and this article here. What magazine is this from, first of all?
I've just got the cover for you here. It's called from a magazine called Zoeklicht, which means Searchlight. Of course, in Britain, that's the name of some kind of political extremism magazine. But it was a Christian magazine, which I rather interestingly found lying around in the hospital, in the ward, in fact, the last time I made a hospital visit. And nobody cleared it away in a common purpose fit of embarrassment about religious content in the hospital, as would happen in Britain. So this is here for patients to read, including people who are thinking about themselves or their loved ones maybe being close to death. And the article title here is asking, is the government or is our government becoming the greatest threat in our life? And it's a double page spread about the Dutch government's political parties in the Hague Parliament, who may form part of the next government that's being formed at the moment. They're pushing for this idea of what they call in Dutch voltooid leven, which is my life is complete. In other words, if you are well but simply old and worried about the burden on society, or it's been induced that you should be worried about the societal burden, then you can choose for a euthanized death, according to this proposal which is coming in, even if you're not suffering at present. So much broader than the current euthanasia law. And I'll read one paragraph, my translation. It says, in our beautiful country, death squadrons will soon be driving around, law in hand, intended to, quote, assist or guide, unquote, people in their desire to die. With the law in the hand, they will sign a little form which entirely is compliant with the law and which prescribes soft death without objection. This declaration form, in other words, that you wish to die, although you're healthy, simply because you're a burden, the claim form that goes along with that can be submitted at the same time with the mileage claim and the overtime hours for the officials who are doing it. All this behind the facade of a beautiful piece of legislation. This will bring about a solution to the problem of failing healthcare, and it will also do away with the problem of expensive healthcare. People who are superfluous to society or who have been made to feel so, people who are in great loneliness and people suffering from depression will then disappear from society. And at the end, because it's a Christian magazine, it says that the government of Romans 13, that is the government who punishes evildoers, is becoming the government of Revelation 13, which is the government that kills its citizens. And it calls its readers to pray for politicians who are against this legislative change. There's a real prospect that this idea of completed life, euthanasia on demand, will come about because the cabinet's being formed and some radical Marxist parties are likely to be in it.
Right. Thank you very much for that, Alex. I'll just say that this is one of the most important issues because, of course, we've had Dark Lord Falconer pushing this sort of policy in the background over many years in UK. The threat from our own government is becoming ever more dangerous. We're about to move on to big issues in relation to America and Syria. Many people see that as the most dangerous threat, but we should never forget what our own government is doing with this sort of legislation at home.
Okay, so let's get on to Trump then and Syria and Russia and so on. Now, last week's meeting between Jens Stoltenberg, who's the Secretary General of NATO, and Donald Trump was bumped so that Trump could meet with President Xi Jinping. And apparently Donald was very happy with that meeting. He said he was very pleased to accept President Xi Jinping's in Mar-a-Lago and to hold a meeting with him. This meeting was very successful. I hope to make a state visit to China. Well, today, Jens Stoltenberg gets his meeting with Trump. So he is to visit the White House this afternoon. They are going to discuss preparations for the meeting of the NATO heads of state and government in Brussels on the 25th of May, including NATO's contribution to the fight against terrorism, in inverted commas, and burden sharing within the NATO alliance. So this morning, Stoltenberg is going to lay a wreath at Arlington National Cemetery. And then this afternoon, he's meeting with, this is local time, of course, is meeting with the President of the United States, the Honourable Donald J. Trump, as the press release puts it. And then tomorrow, he will deliver some remarks at the Elliott School of International Affairs at the George Washington University. So that's fantastic. But there's other stuff going on with NATO, Alex, and with regard to Montenegro. Give us the background to this one.
Well, the background, in essence, is Montenegro was a state attached to Serbia. And together with Serbia, it constituted the rump Yugoslavia after five other republics had left. And so you had this union of Serbia and Montenegro for some years. And around 2012, all of a sudden, Montenegro was hived off. Politicians in Podgorica, the capital of Montenegro, a tiny country, were persuaded that they would get more money through legal and other channels if they backed off from Yugoslavia. So a new independent state was forged where none had ever been, because the Montenegrins are Serbian speakers and Serbian Orthodox, although they have their own branch of the church. And all of a sudden, this was yet another pawn to play with to weaken Serbia. And now, before we know it, Montenegro has been welcomed into NATO. That decision was taken a while ago at NATO ministerial level, but now it's been ratified overwhelmingly by the US Senate, with only two dissenters, one of whom, of course, is Senator Paul, who's been stalwart about this for decades. And in rejecting it, Senator Paul said that this would just be another leech attached to the NATO welfare agency. So that's the side of it he sees. But the other side of it, of course, is that the Montenegrins and the whole Balkans are being lined up to attack Russia. So this proceeds apace, and the language that the White House used in welcoming the Senate's ratification of Montenegrin NATO accession was very telling, because in line with whatever else we're seeing this week, the Trump White House, which pretended in opposition to be rather sceptical about NATO, Trump said it was an institution that had served its purpose at one point, didn't he? Now Trump's spokesman, I think it's Sean Spicer in this case, he who made the unfortunate remark about Hitler never used chemical weapons a couple of days ago. But anyway, Trump's people are saying, we welcome this because NATO is essential to the security of the whole Euro-Atlantic area. So we're back to the decades-long talk of globalism and NATO as the supreme instrument of US foreign policy and defence policy. It's as if nothing has changed.
Absolutely. Well, Trump may well be happy with Xi's visit last week, or at least he's saying so anyway. But the message that Trump delivered, well and truly delivered, was the message was war, not development. And you could say that as a result of the timing of the attack on Syria. Xi, on the other hand, is not so enamoured with US moves regarding North Korea, particularly in light of the fact that it looks like Japan's going to join in the fun. Now, Xi told Trump on a phone call last night that the Syria issue must continue to move towards a political solution and that any use of chemical weapons is unacceptable. You can read into that what you may, but he absolutely was concerned about the armada that America seems to be sending. Trump saying we're sending an armada very powerful to Korea, that is. We have submarines that are very powerful, far more powerful than the aircraft carrier, that I can tell you. And North Korea, as a result, has said that it's responded by saying that our revolutionary strong army is keenly watching every move by enemy elements with our nuclear site focused on the US invasionary bases, not only in South Korea and the Pacific Operations Theater, but also in the US mainland. So, you know, how credible that is, people can make up their own minds on that. But Xi, in his telephone call, saying that the US should absolutely rethink the Syria escalation and they should rethink what they're doing in Korea. And he said China remains willing to maintain communication and coordination with the American side on the issue of the Korean Peninsula, but China advocates resolving the issue through peaceful means. You know, what are your thoughts on the Korean situation, Alex?
It was clearly, Mike, brought about in concert with the Syrian situation, to the extent that President Xi was going to talk about the One Belt, One Road policy, which is Eurasian trade opening up, and he was going to talk about DPRK, North Korea, just an hour before the attack on Syria. In fact, it said that Trump kept Xi waiting, which Xi is not going to respond well to. He's very proud, and he doesn't like being insulted in the name of the Chinese people for whom he stands up. So clearly there's something going on here. At a deeper level, I would say that some people have talked about a red team and blue team, or red empire, blue empire set up within the US-UK setup, where the Department of Defense and British soft power forms a red empire, which is all about violence. And that empire does, I think, want to take down the DPRK, North Korea. But you also have a blue empire, which is the psychological strand that goes through British and American history of how do we shape hearts and minds and exert mind control over other people. And that empire, which was very strong in the US State Department after the war in the Dulles era and so on, that empire actually set up North Korea by deliberately failing to conquer it in the 1950-1953 war. And it's also that blue empire of foreign policy has long regarded Maoist China and its sub-successor states, and also Pol Pot's Cambodia and Kimist North Korea, as ideal testing grounds for extreme mind control policies. So there's a war going on, I think, even within Washington for North Korea, and it's very much tied in with what's happening in Syria, and we're going to come onto that in a moment. But these are ways to get Mr. Trump and the better people in his retinue backed into a corner to force them to do the globalist bidding anyway.
Okay, and the next thing we wanted to highlight was this World Affairs brief. Just tell us a little bit about what this is and who's behind it.
The chap at the top there is Joel Skousen, S-K-O-U-S-E-N, and he's a Mormon. He appears quite a lot on Alex Jones, but on that other outlets as well. And he describes himself as coming from the conservative patriotic wing of Mormonism, because there's several branches of Mormonism. And I was always very impressed by Mormons' geopolitical analysis at GCHQ. My NSA colleagues who were Mormons were some of the best in NSA. And he's got a very sharp view about this. And I think you have some text for us, don't you, as well, from the World Affairs Brief. Skousen is basically a survivalist. So he counsels people on how to survive nuclear attack. And here is, or perhaps it's better for you to read that out, these key paragraphs of Mr. Skousen's analysis.
Yeah, so he's got it in bold, a new warning. I have long said that I didn't think China would unleash North Korea to start World War III until the next decade, because Russia and China are in the midst of a major rearmament, which won't be complete until the 2020-2024 range. Obviously, they would prefer to be fully ready before launching a war. The globalists, on the other hand, would prefer a war earlier rather than later, but they can't make it look like they started the war, so they have worked for 30 years to simply facilitate our enemies' arsenals, transferring military and scientific technology to both China and Russia. Much of those transfers have been done courtesy of the US Commerce Department. Much has also been done through Israel. We sell our top technology to Israel and they sell it to the Russians and the Chinese. With the coming of Donald Trump, I suspect that the globalists may try and kill two birds with one stone. First, let Trump start this war by striking North Korea's nuclear program. And second, let Trump take the blame, which will cost him the next election and forever taint him as the guy who started World War III. In summary, with Donald Trump being snookered so easily into attacking Syria, I'm very much worried he will now attack North Korea, leading him down a path he vowed not to go, intervening militarily around the world. I suspect his globalist advisors may be setting him up for an attack on North Korea's nuclear weapons program that could provoke a Chinese nuclear response against the United States with our anti-missile systems, which our anti-missile systems could not control. Here are the likely or possible scenarios.
Which he then goes on to explain, but they all involve Syria and North Korea being intertwined. It's all about trapping Trump, because although he's an old man, he's quite vain and he's never done any security policy in his life. So in a sense, he's as clueless as these young women journalists in defense that we keep ridiculing for their lack of knowledge of weapon systems and foreign cultures. His vanity has captured him. And I think it's quite easy for a massive globalist system that exists in Washington and London and New York to do this. And so you can see that there's, again, an alliance of interest, a few Luciferians in government or in banks who actually want conflagration because they enjoy death and suffering and population reduction. A lot of Boeing and Raytheon type shareholders and stakeholders thinking, well, this will be great. We can increase our sales and perhaps destroy European competition in defense manufacturing and along the way, and have a repeat order base going from, you know, having to attack Russia and China. Others who just want a war because they're hyped up and on steroids, you know, in the services themselves. You can see the alliance of interests, and I think that, you know, it's coming to the point where the hawks, to use that old-fashioned phrase, are almost winning out on every front now in the US and the UK. There's very few sane voices, and Trump's election seems to have bought us a very limited respite of perhaps only 2 months. In fact, it's probably not set us back. Because his naivety, his gaucheness, or his compromisedness, or whatever it is, has allowed globalists to set up new scenarios.
We shouldn't forget the financial institutions in that as well, by the way, because, of course, they're finding it increasingly difficult to make huge profits off the rest of us because of the economic situation we're in at the moment. But you also wanted to highlight this, Alex, which is a memorandum from veteran intelligence professionals for sanity. More than two dozen ex-US intelligence officials urging Donald Trump to rethink his claims blaming the Syrian government for the chemical deaths in Idlib. And just to give you a feel for this, we write to give you an unambiguous warning of the threat of armed hostilities with Russia, with the risk of escalation to nuclear war. The threat has grown after the cruise missile attack on Syria in retaliation for what you claimed was a chemical weapons attack on April 4th on Syrian civilians in southern Idlib province. Our US Army contacts in the area have told us that is not what happened. There is no Syrian chemical weapons attack. Instead, a Syrian aircraft bombed an Al-Qaeda in Syria ammunition depot that turned out to be full of noxious chemicals, and a strong wind blew the chemical-laden cloud over a nearby village where many subsequently died. This is what the Russians and Syrians have been saying, and more importantly, what they appear to believe happened. Do we conclude that the White House has been giving our generals dictation, that they are mouthing what they've been told to say? And so it goes on. It gives a bit of a timeline. And it ends up by saying, surely it is time to deal with Russia on the basis of facts, not allegations based largely on dubious evidence from social media, for example. While many would view this time of high tension as ruling out a summit, we suggest the opposite may be true. You might consider instructing Secretary Tillerson to begin arrangements for an early summit with President Putin. That would be a pretty positive development if Trump was to take that advice, but I don't suspect that he will.
No, exactly, Mike, because if Trump, who is a very experienced businessman, I'm getting flack in the chat box for calling Trump stupid. He's not stupid. He's just got intelligence that's in other areas. If he was ever put in a room in a formal summit situation with the interpreting headphones on and listening to the views of Mr. Putin and Mr. Xi, of course, head of government, head of state summits are rare in that regard, but they do happen. Then he would understand the urgency and the detail which Putin and Xi and others are able to reel off the top of their heads would persuade him that he'd been lied to. But of course, bag carriers will do anything to preclude that development, to keep him away from it. I think there's a consensus for many analysts that Trump's the information reaching Trump is very filtered now.
Well, just to show who is behind this open letter, we'll just bring up a list of some of the people here. So we've got some pretty serious military and intelligence people. Alex?
We have in particular Ray McGovern, the intelligence whistleblower, and we have Scott Ritter, who those of us who are older or more studied in this will remember was the arms inspector in the Iraq situation, who picked great holes in the globalist plan. So these are people with a good track record in their profession and also proven insights into the globalist mentality acting within the military and security apparatus.
Now, a number of weeks ago, David Scott highlighted a Scottish gentleman, Colin, who had produced some videos which the Scottish establishment didn't seem to like terribly much. You have met him since that, is that correct?
Yes, I've taken him on a walking tour around Rotterdam, where he showed us how completely the Erdogan Turks have taken over the street scene. And his channel is called Millennial Woes, W-O-E-S. And if you look up his videos, the one we're going to show a clip from now is one that he's called Orange Alert. I think that is, as well as being obviously a kind of DEFCON reference, it's also a dig at Mr. Trump's hue of skin, to call it Orange Alert. But if you look at his channel, he's got a lot of stuff. And so we're going to show you a brief clip now of just about 2 minutes and a bit in which he is picking apart Mr. Trump's statement, which I and he both think was actually something he was given to read and pretend it was his own words. And this is Trump's statement defending his attack on Syria against all of his own previous record. So this is what Millennial Woes Colin Robertson has to say about that.
Yeah, this is a perfect encapsulation of what we hate about Western governments, not just America. This idea that our leaders are dishonest, and furthermore that they don't have an attachment to the truth, that they're happy lying. They live in some other realm where honesty doesn't matter, where fealty to the truth doesn't matter. And that's scary, that's terrifying, because then you don't know where you stand with them. You know, they could lie about absolutely anything and everything. So I'll move on to the next stuff. There can be no dispute that Syria used banned chemical weapons, violated its obligations under the Chemical Weapons Convention, and ignored the urging of the UN Security Council. No, it didn't. Again, I'm not going to go into the details of this, but these are just lies. And This is the thing, to hear Trump, that guy who always just said it like it was, here he is, like an automaton, saying things that are untrue. So what's happened? And then he goes on. Years of previous attempts at changing Assad's behaviour have all failed. And this is a lie being built upon other lies. The other lies are that all these other times when Assad was accused of using chemical weapons, and it was later debunked, and Trump himself pointed out that it was a lie, that Assad had not used chemical weapons. And now here he is, directly contradicting himself from a year ago, or even from a few days ago. A few days ago, he was happy to leave Assad in power on the 30th of March. And yet now he's talking about years of previous attempts at changing Assad's behaviour have all failed, and failed very dramatically. That's sinister. It's scary. You know, the depth and the hardness of this lie.
So, Alex.
So, yeah, there we go. That is Colin Robertson. And what that shows to me is Colin himself has described his past in his video. He's my age, or perhaps just a couple of years younger, mid-30s he is. And he was an art student who didn't know what he wanted out of life, and then went into a kind of long, dark night of the soul and spent some wilderness years. And he's emerged from that at my age, just old enough to remember, you know, how the news used to be reported, right, when the BBC was rather better. And he's managed to put two and two together. He understands when chemical weapons would be deployed and when they wouldn't. Just a sensible, ordinary world, real world understanding. And this is lacking in the younger crowd of MPs and defence correspondents. It's also perhaps lacking in someone older like Mr. Trump, who's spent his life in vanity projects and built up business acumen, but that doesn't have any more, you know, sense about diplomacy as such. It just shows that the most dangerous kind of person, and this is why Colin Robertson was persecuted by the Scottish establishment, is just an ordinary guy with some common sense who's thought about the situation of the nations of the world and sees when things are screamingly obvious lies. And I think that's the kind of person whom the establishment wants to silence at all costs.
I totally agree with that. And in a few minutes, we're going to have a look at some of the, we'll call it the American deep state's spin and propaganda apparatus that has been attacking anybody who doubts the official view.
Well, yesterday we mentioned Jim Mattis, Secretary of Defense, and his statement, the Syrian government would be ill-advised ever again to use chemical weapons, delivered it, what it seemed to me anyway, delivered as a threat, and also hinting that perhaps, the fix is in. We can expect further chemical weapons alleged chemical weapon attacks to take place, more false flags. Well, Putin, in fact, has decided to call this one out, and Russia, through TASS, saying that they have data that new provocations are planned in Syria, with the goal of putting the blame on Damascus for allegedly using chemical weapons. Putin said, we have information from different sources that these provocations, I cannot call them otherwise, are being prepared in other regions of Syria, including in the southeastern suburbs of Damascus, where there are plans to throw some substances and accuse the official Syrian authorities. He said, we believe that any incident of this kind should be officially investigated. We plan to turn to the United Nations bodies in The Hague and to call on the global community to thoroughly investigate this incident and make sure balanced decisions come from the investigation's outcome. So the US attack on Syria, he said, strongly reminds us of the 2003 events when United States representatives in the UN Security Council showed allegedly chemical weapons found in Iraq. So, Alex, the Russians absolutely not buying any of this stuff and being pretty strong in their words, Putin in particular, basically saying, expect a false flag because it's coming?
Yeah, the Russians have to not budge an inch on this because they're no fools, and they have heard what even Wes Clark said, which is that there was a seven-nation list of nations in the greater Middle East ending up with Iran. And it looks that Iran has jumped in the pecking order of this, you could call it, Israeli stroke neocon attack list. Maybe it was not, it was even from the 2000s onwards, it was not going to be the seventh and last of the nations to be attacked, but the one directly after Syria. That's the sense I got. And that time has now come. The globalists are years behind schedule and in a hurry, as they always are, because their plans are always thwarted and fall apart at the last minute. But they're desperate to get into Iran. And if Iran is attacked, that's it. Russia's next. Using the increasingly active belt of Turkic nations and the terrorists whom we've trained in those nations right through to China, Russia's southern flank, rather, is going to be for it, together with the Sorosite undermining of Russian youth throughout the territory of Russia. So this is really existential for Russia. It has to be stopped with Syria.
Absolutely. Now, very briefly, Alex, I don't know whether you saw yesterday's programme we were discussing. We mentioned Georgia once again, because the South Ossetian situation being ramped up with elections and a referendum, and the Georgian government refusing to recognise that situation. That's along the same kind of lines.
It is, because the West has maundered on about national self-determination for a long time, and now Abkhazia and South Ossetia, admittedly they're Russian protectorates, they don't make any bones about that, but these mini-nations which have declared their independence from Georgia a long time ago, 1992, after ethnic wars at the time, by the way, they have now said a generation later, you know what, we want to plough our own course in close association with Russia, and in the case of South Ossetia, we want to leave the door open to union with our brethren in North Ossetia, which would involve absorption into Russia, but it's primarily about reuniting the Ossetian people. So apparently this Wilsonian doctrine of national self-determination is not for nations in Eurasia. It's only for those of interest to the Anglo-American project around the periphery.
Okay, let's move on to Brexit then. And this is the Public Administration and Constitutional Affairs Subcommittee, Select Committee rather, who've published a report. What was really interesting about this report is that it doesn't focus on Russia too much. It does mention Russia, but doesn't focus on it too much. But if you read many of the mainstream news articles on this today, it's all about Russia and the fact that the allegation that foreign governments, and of course we know that they're meaning Russia, had interfered with the electoral registration system in the UK in the run-up to the Brexit vote, and that had caused the electoral registration system to crash, and that had therefore affected the Brexit result. Well, what were they actually saying? Well, the report is actually about lessons learned from the Brexit referendum. It criticised the lack of proper contingency planning for a leave vote, because the government was at least pretending at that point that it wanted to remain within the EU, and it was doing all its contingency planning for staying within the EU. And so they were criticising that. They insisted that governments have a constitutional and public obligation to prepare for both potential outcomes of any referendum. Bernard Jenkin, who's the chairman of the committee, said the use of the machinery of government during referendums has a significant effect on public trust and confidence. Referendums, therefore, need to be designed in such a way as to provide the utmost clarity for parliamentarians, campaigners and, above all, the electorate. It's of highest importance that the referendum process is seen as fair by both sides and that the result is agreed to, even if not with, by both sides. So that was his statement on the report. And as you can see, Russia not really mentioned at all, but the mainstream media would have it slightly differently. So while the committee didn't identify who may have been responsible, it did note that both Russia and China use an approach to cyber attacks based on the understandings of mass psychology and of how to exploit individuals. Now, this did put a smile on my face, Brian, because if there's any country in the world which is looking at the understanding of mass psychology at the moment, it is Britain, and has been for quite some time. Common Purpose being a perfect example of the implementation of that interest in mass psychology. But we have the Behavioural Insights team, an organisation hived off from the Cabinet Office, which is now selling its services to other governments around
America
the world.
And Australia,
yes,
were the two initial ones.
Alex?
I'm going to tweet out a fresh version of it, but I have already tweeted out last week that a channel called Gad Saad has interviewed Steve Hilton, the political guru under Cameron, who apparently wants a crowd-funded political action. Now, we've covered that. He was interviewing him on Inter Alia about the Behavioural Insights team, which was Steve Hilton's brainchild just a few days ago. And if you listen from 18 minutes onwards, he actually says, yes, I remember when we span it off and commercialised it with the Americans and the French got interested. And we went down to France on the Eurostar in Sarkozy's day to sell the concept. And he says, I remember having this blazing row with fellow policy wonks because Steve Hilton says, I'm an upfront kind of guy. And I said, this team is going to be there to change behaviour. So we need to call it the Behavioural Change Team. And of course, everyone on the Eurostar party had kittens and said, you can't call it that. That's totalitarian. And Hilton said, but that's what we're going to do with it. We're going to change people's behavior. But of course, his colleagues won out. So it became known as the Behavioral Insights Team. And this is going back to 2006-ish. I remember it coming in when I was at GCHQ, certainly no later than 2008. So this plan to change people's behavior was there being discussed a decade ago. And the Americans and French, surprise, surprise, were the governments most interested in learning from us in that regard.
Okay, well, let's move on to Europol then, because, of course, and we've sort of mentioned other aspects of this in the last couple of weeks, but Europol has hosted a conference on Monday and Tuesday this week on online terrorist propaganda. And, of course, Europol, one of the European institutions that we will not be leaving, even if we leave the European Union in name. So we will remain part of Europol. And on this occasion, 150 participants gathered at Europol's headquarters in The Hague to discuss a wide variety of topics pertaining to the online terrorist threat. Participants included members of the ECTC Advisory Group on Terrorist Propaganda, representatives of the EU Commission and the EU Council, academia, law enforcement practitioners from Europe and the United States. And so what was this about? The result of the multi-stakeholder cooperation that they want were presented to Europol's conference alongside topics ranging from solutions on how to analyse big data and map terrorist networks online to insights into online behaviour, tactics in the communication of terrorists. The outcome of the conference will help Europol and the EU law enforcement in general to better focus on counter-terrorism efforts, as well as to enhance the tools and techniques in place towards more effective prevention and investigation. But at the heart of this is Europol's attempts to censor the internet. So the EU Internet Referral Unit, the IRU, is part of the EU Internet Forum. It's a public-private partnership launched at the initiative of the EU Commission in December 2015, and this forum has two key objectives. First of all, to reduce accessibility to terrorist content online, and secondly, to empower civil society partners to increase the volume of effective alternate narratives online. Alex, this is spectacularly dangerous. We've heard the British government making the same kinds of noises. So what we're going to do on one hand is we're going to pretend that we know what people should be reading and watching on one hand, and on the other hand, we're going to take our narratives. This is what they're saying. They're going to take their narratives and they're going to amplify those as much as possible and attempt to drown out any counter narrative to what the government is pushing forward. It's pretty dangerous.
It is, Mike, because Europol is not just a European Union miniature version of Interpol. That would be bad enough because Interpol was conceived of basically by Nazism and was held by Hjalmar Schacht and the like during the Nazi era. But no, Europol is worse than that because it doesn't have, like the other international organisations, a staff code of conduct and a recruitment process. In my understanding, Europol is entirely staffed by liaison officers from national police forces, something that Britain doesn't have anyway. Well, Scotland does now, but from the Met, basically, in our case. And they are sent off under their own police codes of conduct, either reframed or being reframed. And they go into this atmosphere in The Hague. They inhabit the old Gestapo building in The Hague and go off to Brussels for conferences as well with politicians. And they do the bidding of Brussels politics or whatever, their bosses in The Hague, without having any frame of reference, as far as I can see, as to what their role is as international police officers or whatever they call themselves. They're just following terms of reference from their own national headquarters, from their interior ministry, and they get into a hive mentality with no regulation, as far as I can see. So if it can be persuaded, if an idea can be put in their minds that, you know, you're there to internationalise policing and to stop radicalisation, as you mentioned there, Mike, there's no way for them to have any reference, frame of reference, for what's legal, lawful and proper. They just do, I think, as far as I can see, what they feel like and what their corporate culture tells them to do.
Certainly agree with that, Alex. Now, we're just going to recap on a little bit of the work we did on the news yesterday, which was focusing on an organisation called Stratfor, which is geopolitical analysis. And we picked up on this lady, Riva Gujon. Now, she's the vice president. She's apparently a global analyst. And the reason we were interested in her was she was pumping out that an organisation called DFR Lab had analysed the response to the Idlib gas attack and said that anybody that was challenging the UK, US international view that Assad did it was clearly right wing. And indeed, there that anybody with a view against the official line was linked back to an Assad, pro-Assad website. So we pointed out that this was absolutely ridiculous propaganda coming out of these people. Now, just to simplify it a bit, I've put it into a UK column wiring diagram. But remember, we started on this trail with the good old BBC that was promoting Stratfor. Here it is. And if you go and look at this organisation, particularly their Twitter page, you will see that it's rabidly anti-Russian, anti-Assad. Here's the lovely Riva. Now, apparently, this very young lady is an expert on geopolitical analysis, not only in the Middle East, but I think she's also done some at South America as well. And she was promoting this organization, Digital Forensic Research Lab. And where do they come from? Well, a very dark, I've called it deep state organization, the Atlantic Council. It says it's private, it's independent, but this is really at the heart of NATO and EU policy. This is really high level policy around this organization. And it just happens to run the very research lab that then attacks any and everybody who has come up and said, well, we don't believe the official line that Assad was guilty of that gas attack. So the research lab used two journalists, one Dinara Barajan here. She was praising their own work in saying anybody that criticises the official line is a right-wing extremist. And Ben Nimmo here also praised his own work by saying they only produce well-researched, balanced articles. But of course, the article that they did produce was so biased against Assad and anybody who dared criticise their policy as to be laughable. So this is a machine at work here. And of course, when we follow it through the BBC's LinkedIn, we've got this very interesting group, Atlantic Council. This is the deep state propaganda machine. And before I ask Alex to comment, let's just carry on through a couple of slides. Now, thank you very much for the viewer that saw the lovely Riva speaking on a Turkish program. She said some extremely interesting things. Now, we've just picked up on a bit of it, but she said that Turkey is being pulled in many directions. Europe is fragmenting. The West is in confrontation with Russia. And of course, Turkey has an important role to play with its military and economic power. We're going to be seeing more of Turkey in coming years. Now, this lady is so young, and I have to say, there must be a limitation to her knowledge. I think what she's regurgitating here is the policy which she hears being spouted around us. So I've labelled it out of the mouths of babes, because I think she doesn't really realise that she is actually revealing what the plan is. So Turkey is to be beefed up and promoted. She says, when I look at the Middle East region, Turkey, Iran and Saudi are very important powers, but very big internal Saudi difficulties means the Saudi role will decline over time. That's an interesting one. And key powers will be Turkey and Iran, and there's going to be competition between the two of them. And then we go to this. There's obviously been a question about the New World Order. Depends what you mean by the New World Order. I see several big themes. Europe fragmenting will continue. Blocks of like-minded countries will form. Europe is in for a rough road ahead. Russia is assertive, but internal weakness will pull Russia's attention within. Now, that tension is my words. I had to paraphrase some of this. China has been driving growth ahead economically, but painful political and society dislocation inside China will demand attention. China is vulnerable. I think what we're looking at here, Alex, is that this young woman, out of the mouth of this particular babe, she is actually giving us what the long-term plan is, that Turkey's going to be reinforced. They're going to try and stir up trouble inside Russia. They're going to do the same with China. This cannot be this young lady's own analysis. This has got to be coming from the establishment around her, surely.
Yes, Ryan, and there's some giveaways there. I noticed, by the way, that when the Turks subtitled this, they removed some throwaway lines of uncomfortable truth that she mentioned, such as when she was asked about Turkey's role in the Middle East, she said, yes, the Turks have been doing incursions into Iraqi Kurdistan, and that was, of course, left out of the Turkish subtitling because the Turks aren't supposed to be embarrassed by that. But no, this is Washington general talk, generals talk, I should say, and not of regular military guys either, but the ones who live in these think tanks. And she's picked up some crucial things there. She's basically said that Washington has realized, and I think Israel too, that with backing the Saudi monarchy, the British, Americans and Israelis are flogging a dead horse. The Saudis are just collapsing. There's economically and culturally and politically, there's not much future in Saudi Arabia with the oil price the way it is and the way that women's lib is going even in Saudi Arabia. So the alternative ways of keeping the Middle East nice and chaotic and disturbed and divided are these strong, growing, demographically promising and very nationalist non-Arab nations, Turkey and Iran, both of which are proud about having their own civilization apart from Arab Islam. And so they're going to have to be psyched up and destabilized. That's why all the soft power and the retraining is going into getting Turks and Iranians re-educated, basically. The focus on that growing number of young people in Turkey and Iran and their diaspora abroad is massive, and you can see why. And she also lets slip, of course, that the Europeans have proven to be a disappointment to this plan because they're going back to their old so-called faults of pursuing national interest. In other words, the Europeans are not going to be any good as a storm front against Russia because they're going to follow national interests and say, no, we're not going to invade Russia. So instead, as you say, Brian, the project is switching to using Turkey and Iran to do that as well, instead rather.
Yeah, well, we will thank Reva. I shall tweet out after the news and thank her in person for telling us what's planned.
But Alex, one of the things that Reva hinted at there was that there would be destabilization within Russia and also within China. And of course, it's the Muslim community within China that is one of the hotspots, shall we say, for such destabilization. And you've highlighted this Reuters article, China sets rules on beards, veils to combat extremism in Xinjiang.
Yes, and this is the eastern end of the Turkic front, which Gladio B has been all about, you know, training them up. And so we've seen the ethnic Turks of Western China called the Uyghurs, U-Y-G-H-U-R, the Uyghur nation in what used to be called Chinese Turkestan. They're getting so radical that the Chinese government is, okay, it's a nasty secularist government, but it is, I think, with good reason, forcing people not to grow obviously Islamic beards anymore because the threat is too massive of having people indoctrinated and brought into separatism. And if you just look just west of Xinjiang, you get the Central Asian nations of Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, a long problem there in the Fergana Valley with Hizbut Tahrir radicals, with a big tie into Britain there, by the way, and others who've been, you know, over 20 years now, to the great chagrin of the Russians, have been stoked up in the country. And increasingly in the European terrorist attacks we see, the patsies, or maybe the real culprits, but the names we're given and the nationalities we're given, they do come from Kyrgyzstan and southern Uzbekistan. So the eastern end of the Turkic belt is definitely swinging, I think, up into perhaps high gear now as the way in which Russia and China are going to be destabilized. So when you see these awful reports coming out about religious persecution in China, and it is awful, you have to bear in mind that even if the Chinese government were a benevolent one, you know, a kind of Kuomintang-type Chinese nationalism with no communism attached to it, even if they were not globalists, they would still have this problem of the Muslims and increasingly the Christians being used to destabilize the unity of China. So we have to take a long, hard look at ourselves, really, and what we're doing there if we're horrified by what China does to repress its citizens.
Yeah, indeed. Right, we will end on this one then. So here we've got Finnish Foreign Minister Timo Soini and the head of the Civil Preparedness Section in NATO, Lorenz Meyer-Minneman. Well, apparently the NATO and EU have been making love, and they came together in Helsinki yesterday and formally agreed to establish a European Centre of Excellence for Countering Hybrid Threats. This ceremony was attended by several people, including the two on screen. Nine nations are included in the memorandum: Finland, France, Germany, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Sweden, the UK and the United States. Other NATO and EU nations are expected to join the centre in the near future. And while not signatories themselves, NATO and the EU will participate actively in the centre's activities. So they say that countering hybrid threats is a priority for NATO as they blur the line between war and peace. I'm not quite clear, Alex, what they mean by that. They mean blurring the line between war and peace in the sense that we are going to be perpetually at war and there will be no peace.
I think, Mike, this is coming increasingly from the EU side, not from the NATO side. There was a very interesting article in the French press this week with Dominique Moïse, who is the chief neocon think tank man of France, and he's one of those who is a senior advisor to the College of Europe, set up in Churchill's time, actually, by the founding fathers of the EU to be the EU's think tank. And Moïse is saying, now that Syria has been attacked, everything has changed. The EU needs a military capacity, and it needs to subordinate that to America. So there's a complicated trilateral game going on, but basically the founding fathers of the EU and their successors today are thinking, how can we continue to play like big boys in the world? Well, we need to hang on to America's coattails to do it. If NATO's going to fail, then we need to do it through the EU route. Again, it's competing groups with so much analysis of globalism. You can't get carried away with where is the one room of men plotting this stuff. It's actually an interplay of competing interests, all of whom see a moment to seize their chance, but with the same agenda behind them.
Alex, thank you very much for joining us as always and your excellent analysis. And we'll say to our viewers and listeners, if you're getting really concerned about what's happening, and we all should be concerned, it's up to all of us to do something about it. And that requires speaking out, putting your head above the parapet and taking action. We need to challenge these people. We're being attacked by our own governments, whether it's in the US or the UK or other European countries, in fact. And it's only when enough people say, no, we're not having this, we're going to put a stop to it. So the time has come for action. If you haven't got your ticket for the 22nd of April Nottingham event, please buy it, come along, and let's talk about what can and should be done. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.